Welcome to Following the Leftovers, the officially unofficial podcast for The Leftovers on HBO. I'm the lucky leader.
And I'm Drunken Desperado.
What? Why did I say what I just said?
I will never reveal the secret of the Wu-Tang Clan.
No? Okay.
So if you notice, if you're paying attention to credits, Andrea S., many people sent this email to us, and I got it right away, and I'll tell the story about that here in a minute, but Andrea S. was the first one to send it, that Damon Lindelof and Tom Parada put in their names through the Wu-Tang Clan name generator, which is, if you just Google it, you can find it, and they were credited as The Lonely Donkey Kong and Specialist Contagious.
All right, I like the second one better.
Yeah.
The Lonely Donkey Kong is not great.
Interestingly enough, because I imagine a lot of people will do this, I looked up a couple of the names, like Kevin Garvey, Unlucky Dreamer, Nora Durst, Tough Bandit.
Okay.
I like the Tough Bandit.
Sure.
It's T-U-F-F, too, so you can take it a lot of different ways.
Right.
Tough Bandit.
Huh.
So there you go. There you go. I'm the Drunken Desperado.
All right.
There a lot of Easter eggs in the beginning of this. It did the classic Leftovers credit sequence with the Perfect Strangers theme song.
Yeah.
Now, I grew up as an unironic fan of the Perfect Strangers.
Yeah.
Like I still think the Bibby Bobka episode is like a top 10 funniest thing I've ever seen. Now again, I was like 11 when I saw it, but
haven't
still,
seen it since. Yeah,
it's pretty good. So I immediately recognized what they were doing, and yeah, I thought it's another amazing episode. What did you think?
Did you ever see any of the rap videos that they put out around Perfect Strangers?
I don't think so.
I think there was only one. Was
it Cousin Larry and Balky doing it, or was it?
Bronson Pinchot or whatever his name is, doing a really terrible rap video. And this was tucked away in the darkest recesses of my mind. And then I was on YouTube searching around for like theme song and stuff like that. And this popped up and I was like, oh my God, that's right.
Yeah.
It's maybe one of the worst rap videos you'll ever see. It's from the early 90s.
There was a lot of bad rap in the late 80s, early 90s. Like that was the go-to thing for like your principal to do during a DARE conference. It was the goat, like Bartman had a terrible one, the Super Bowl Shuffle.
Yep.
Like, oh, there's a new thing. Let's do it without really understanding it.
And without having any talent for it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the guy.
My name is Aaron Hubbard, and I'm here to say.
Oh, it's worse.
I like
than
eating
that.
Apple pie every day.
Because he's trying to do the accent.
Yeah.
At
really?
Same time. Yeah,
oh,
he's
God.
Being Balky, and the whole thing is Balky B. It's terrible. Look it up. Balky B rap if you want to.
And we should have seen this coming because the episode, I mean,
yeah.
This is a joke, inside joke of The Leftovers that's run through it. In the first season, it was revealed that the entire cast of Perfect Strangers, in one of the background things, one of the odd little statistical happenings, the entire primary cast of Perfect Strangers departed.
Yeah.
Then in second season, it was revealed that Marklin Baker had actually been hiding out in Mexico because he couldn't deal with the strain of being the only principal cast member that wasn't.
Yeah.
Here, this episode is Don't Be Ridiculous, which is Balky's catchphrase. Yep. That's like, you know, Urkel's Did I Do That? And it features a cameo, a guest starring.
A pretty powerful performance by Marklin Baker. Like, I was impressed.
And I listened to a really great interview with Damon Lindelof with Andy and Chris over at the Watch podcast on the Ringer Network. Marklin Baker is a really impressive guy. He does have 2 Yale degrees.
Okay.
And he said, you know, when we considered doing this, we went on to Wikipedia. We said we did a deep dive into Mark's history. And by that, I mean, of course, we went to Wikipedia.
Right.
And like everything just was gold. Like, oh, my God. Like, you know, we kind of wanted this to be an intellectual appeal because we knew that if you just any old schmo goes to Nora Durst.
Yeah.
He's going to be shot down, and it's like a fit hand in glove. It's like this weird inside joke that they did on a lark just keeps paying off. And
it makes perfect sense that it would happen, that he would come back during a Nora episode, because Nora is essentially him, right? In that she lost the people closest to. I'm going to say that Marklin Baker was closest to the cast of Perfect Strangers.
Sure.
That's all he had in the world.
Uh-huh,
and they were taken from him, right, in this departure. Same thing happened to Nora. Exactly. Like when he says, you know, four out, like one out of four, what are the odds? And she has done the calculation because she's in that exact situation.
Right.
It makes perfect sense. We should have seen it coming. Yeah.
It's great, but just, it's, you know, like just everything is, they just have all these fundamentally silly concepts, like Mark Lynn Baker coming and pitching this to Nora, that Nora would cover up her kids, that Nora would have a Wu-Tang Clan tattoo, and how she would get it, and that she would do trampoline therapy with Erica. And if, like, I'm thinking if we just got a random email that asserted this last week, we'd be like, this, oh, fuck off.
Right.
Fuck off. But they do it, and they do it with in the style that they do it, and it's solid gold.
Yeah, so we are on the mailing list for HBO.
Yes.
And we saw a couple of images from this before.
Like late Friday.
Right, before the episode aired. Uh-huh. And you were looking at them, and you're like, is that a Wu-Tang symbol?
Yeah, I saw Nora with this. I said, oh, she's got her cast off. I'm like, is that? And here's the thing. Like, you can back me up on this. Like, 4 or 5 weeks ago, I said on lunch, because we talk, you know, one of our, you know, this is a little stealth ad for Club Bald Move, but we do this thing on Fridays where it's lunch with Jim and Aaron. Mm-hmm. We talk about random bullshit, and we take Q&A from the audience, whatnot.
Yep.
And I mentioned that, like, one of my little cultural black holes is I'd never heard the Wu-Tang Clan.
Right.
And I just, like, okay, I'm like, okay, well, I've got, you know, Google Play, like, you know, the paid version of that, and they've got the entire catalog, so I'll go ahead, entered Wu-Tang Clan and listen to it, and it's of course fucking amazing.
Obviously,
like anytime someone says it's like a seminal work of anything, if you don't like it, you're probably an asshole.
Uh-huh.
And I try not to be an asshole, and it's amazing. So like there again, like this show continues. I feel like it's fucking made for me.
Yeah.
Like I just got into Wu-Tang Clan. Are you kidding me? And then 5 weeks later, Nora Durst shows up with a Wu-Tang Clan tattoo in her arm.
Yeah, the most random possible thing for Nora.
Get
right
out of my head, Damon.
No, that's great.
So yeah, of course I like. Now it's so weird because you deal with these rarefied airs, right? In this television show, and I was trying to think on my way to the studio today that I actually like this better than the last week's episode, and I don't think so, but I don't even know what that means, because like last week it was just such a joy to see this world back and to get reconnected to all the characters, and you know, Nora's one of my favorite characters. What does it mean? Like if this episode's not as good as last week's, what does it even mean?
Right. Yeah.
What,
at this
can
point,
I ask you like, your opinion? What did you?
Yeah, I thought this episode was really good. Again, you know, it's been on a run since really the beginning of season two, so I hesitate to even compare the episodes to each other at this point. Like, I will compare it to other shows.
That's a good point, because you're right. From season, or I'll even go back to, like, the finale of season one.
Yeah.
I don't think this show has had a bad episode or even, like, an average episode. And that's crazy. I it's very rare to say that about any television show.
Yeah. So, I don't know that, you know, it's really fair to compare, like, oh, is the Nora episode better than the Kevin episode or the Matt episode? And
they seem like they're going to that well, though.
They are
siloing
yeah.
up the characters
for the most part, and they're kind of already trying to spin the mythos of this season into it. Like, what is the deal with this pack of women running around? Obviously,
the four horsewomen
trying to find
the
Kevin, right? The the Kevin mentioned in the book of Kevin. I don't know how she got her hands on that.
That's got to be a flash forward, right?
Got to be. Yeah. I mean, that book is probably coming with them to Australia.
Unless my theory about Michael surreptitiously putting out the book of Kevin in some kind of digital format
on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. Throwing it out there on BitTorrent.
Amazon $3.99 ebook.
sure. Yeah.
That would probably kill your holy book faster than anything, right? Putting it on the Amazon ebook store, the Kindle store.
I know, sell for a dollar. I mean, shit, I sold an improbable amount of copies of my Walking Dead book way back when.
Yeah, but I could see going to Amazon for that. But your holy books?
Yeah, yeah.
Your prophetic visions? Maybe not.
I just wonder, like, with all the weird subgenres of internet, I wonder if there isn't, like, you know, that isn't like a little boomtown, like just weird post-apocalyptic literature.
There's probably like burgeoning religions on the internet that I just don't know about.
You haven't heard of the Book of Aaron yet?
I have not.
Or as his prophetic name, Drunken Desperado.
Right.
Well,
I have heard of that guy.
For $1.99, you can find out all about him on Amazon. Hey, before we get into further discussion of the episode, want to do some housekeeping real quick. Want to shout out Michael Narwaki for being a real gent. He sent us 4 bottles of booze through the mail. As you know, our custom is when we drink when we podcast, and when we podcast really good stuff, we like to drink really good, you know, scotch and whiskey.
Yeah.
For our last season of The Leftovers, he sent 3 bottles to us, a Glenmorangie for Jim, Macallan for me, and Copper Fox for my wife, Cecily, to enjoy throughout. And we've already started doing that. So thank you very much. He also sent another bottle for an upcoming commission podcast project. I don't want to spoil too much, but thank you for that. That was an unexpected treat.
Yeah.
I went from like skepticism when I got a big box that sloshed around to open delight. So thank you for that, Michael. Also, this week we just released a podcast on the Nicolas Cage version of The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
Oh, man. And it's a hoot. We're also recording a wrap-up of Season 2 of Sci-Fi's The Expanse with our pal Levi tonight. That will be out sometime this week. We also have first-run movie The Circle with Tom Hanks in it this week. We also have continuing coverage of Better Call Saul and Fargo. If you can't get enough Carrie Coon, guess what? You can get more Carrie Coon and malfunctioning equipment in Fargo. And we got coverage of all that stuff. Pretty packed week, which is going to be all of our weeks for the next 8 to 10. So check those out at baldmove.com. So before we start talking about, like, you know, the details of the episode, I want to talk about the relationships and themes.
Okay.
Around Kevin and Nora, because I was thinking about this a lot after I watched the episode, because I've observed that I think Kevin and Nora are genuinely in love.
Yep.
They do have this pattern where, like, they declare emotional bankruptcy. Like, I've been doing all this weird shit. Oh, you've been doing all this weird shit? Okay. Yeah. We're going to be open and honest with each other. And, you know, this started from, like, you know, like Nora saying, I don't know how to talk to you. And right. Kevin revealing, like, all the weird shit that he's been doing. And they get back together and have a clean slate. And then they start drifting apart.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Kevin can't tell her that he sees this dead woman. Nora can't talk to Kevin about how badly, you know, missing Lily, having another child ripped away from her for reasons she doesn't really fully understand.
Yeah.
Hurts. And we see in the season that, like, they're still going through the motions of being in love and being intimate and close, but they've drifted apart again.
Would you say they're perfect strangers?
Yes, I would, except for I had someone in feedback asserted that, and I'd hate to drink their milkshake.
Ah, shit. Well, I'll drink it up.
You drank it up. So that is an interesting theme. I also, and I don't know where this is going, because in Lindelof's podcast with Chris and Andy, they talked about how the flash forward, or whatever you want to call it, and there's reason to doubt maybe that it's a flash forward after this episode, puts things in a pretty bleak perspective as far as if you're a Kevin and Nora, you know, shipper.
Yeah, he's nowhere to be found. The mention of a possible Kevin
right.
seems to bring back some maybe bad memories.
But it's also interesting because it's hard for me when I look at Tom and Damon, and they've had at the end of every season, they didn't know they're going to get another season.
Mm-hmm.
So they went in designing a season finale that would work as a series finale.
Sure.
And every single one has ended on a emotionally positive note. It's hard for me to believe that this, knowing that it's going to be the end, that they're just going to put now. That they're going to put the emotional screws to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of taking that as a matter of faith, because to say otherwise, you'd have to say Damon Lindelof, when he's not sure he's going to get another one, goes for happy places. When he knows he's going to be wrapping things up, he just fucking takes a brick bat to your head.
Okay.
And I know that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe
it's revenge for everyone saying how bad Lost sucked. I don't know.
Right. I don't have the established patterns of Lindelof kind of in my book of tricks here.
Yeah.
So not sure where he's going to end this thing, but really it's about the journey, right?
Right.
As much as the show has been about the journey, I think watching the show is also about the journey.
The other thing I want to touch on, Nora, is things in previous seasons that we've heard asserted about her.
Okay.
We've heard asserted by scientists that she is the human instrument of the demon Azrael. And
when was that?
That was when she had this phone call where, you know, the scientists had talked about how they've been studying and there's something special about her. And they're like, you know, kind of similar to Kevin listening to Dean, and he starts talking about dog DNA, and then the soundtrack goes, wah, wah. She was like listening, like, you know, with like rapt attention. And he goes, we believe that you are the human agent of the demon Azrael. And then she's like, oh, for fuck's sake.
Right,
but it's interesting because like that is that demon Azrael has a tradition in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, and they all assert different things about him. That he, one is like he's the angel of death. One is that he is responsible for making sure souls survive the safe transit from earth to heaven. One that he is the one that organizes and sorts prayers incoming into heaven and delivers them to God. That's all interesting. The other thing that was asserted about her is that she is a lens. Do you remember that theory?
Not really.
There's some people that have some kind of lens effect, and the departure didn't affect them, but there's an unusual statistical concentration of departures around them.
Right.
All of these, I guess, to say that these are all designed to seemingly to make Nora feel like she doesn't have control of her own life, and that some of these things are her fault.
Sure.
So if I just want to just put those out there so we can kind of to look at her behavior going forward, because in this episode, I think what Mark Lynn Baker said to her that really resonated was that he is a very smart person that is tired of being jerked around and he wants control.
Yeah.
So
and she feels that sympathy with him kind of in the same position that she was or is.
First up, so branching off of that, I guess we can start talking about the episode proper.
Yeah.
What is there anything that's interesting that ties into Nora's both thematically and maybe in some theory craft with Nora's failure to get electronic things to work for her?
Yeah, I was trying to figure that out, and I'm kind of stumped on it. Like, I don't know why, and it's not just her, right? It seems to be tied more to like the action she's doing rather than her doing the action, because like when she goes into the airport and she can't get the terminal to work, neither can the service agent there. Right. I'm trying to figure out what the goal of this is, like what is it trying to prevent her from doing, or what is it trying to say to her?
Right.
I mean, it seems to be just a reminder that she is very disappointed in the fact that she is no longer a mother. I mean, that is basically what I'm getting out of it, because she's trying to, first of all, travel, and it says, do you want an infant on your lap? And she says, no, I don't have an infant on my lap,
right.
And the machine won't let her choose no.
She wants to go visit her daughter.
She tries to go visit her daughter, the machine says no.
She wants to return home to her family. The machine says no. It's almost like these are barriers that she then thrashes or gets around or subverts. Interestingly, and completely coincidentally, coincidence in the same, like, you know, general supernatural sense of the departure itself, in Fargo, this is, I saw this discussion on Reddit, and people were crying Fargo spoilers, but this literally happens in the first 15 minutes of the first 15 episode. This is a fucking character premise. It's not a goddamn spoiler. But Nora Durst plays a role in the new Fargo, and her first scene in the show is a door sensor failing to recognize her and open for her.
Yeah,
this has got to be one of the great coincidences of all time.
It's pretty good.
Like less than 3 days separate, Nora Carrie Coon. I said I'm referring
Nora
to her
Coon,
as her character name.
Carrie Durst.
Carrie Coon. Can't get a door to open for her, and then she has a series of technological breakdowns.
Yeah.
But I think that's another thing of, like, her, the universe trying to put her in a box and tell her what she can't do, and her saying, fuck you to the universe.
Yeah, I mean, it can also be, like, a... So I read a WatchingTheLeftovers.com article. I think that's HBO's official...
Yep.
Leftovers blog.
Right, their propaganda arm.
Yeah, where they were interviewing Nora, or Carrie Coon, rather. And she was talking about Nora in season 3 and how in season 2 she was very much more hopeful than she kind of starts out here in season 3.
Mm-hmm.
in season two, she had just moved to a new place. She had just acquired a new family, essentially.
Right.
And she was trying to be that person again. She was trying to reclaim the identity that she lost when her family was raptured, you mm-hmm. know, departed. And that always... And she was talking about how that always feels like a veneer on Nora.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like she is fully coming to terms with the question of who am I, or like identity questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that like magnified in this episode, right? Everything that she tries to do around family is either thwarted somehow, like supernaturally, or attempted anyway, to be thwarted, or it is a reminder of the fact that these people are gone, and now you are left, and you have to do something, you know, with your life.
Yeah.
You have to be a person. What are you going to do with that?
And it's not defined by a third party or another human being.
And she's still, like, maniacally gripping on to this, I'm a mother, I'm a family woman, that kind of thing. Whereas maybe she should just take a step back and say, who do I want to be? Who can I be?
What, so do you think, I mean, I know what I think, but do you think that it's a fundamentally a healthy thing that she laughs in Kevin's face about the suggestion of having a baby?
At this moment, yes. I don't think at this moment that that's a good idea for either of them.
Because if her arc or what she needs to do is define her own happiness about, you know, around herself... You know, and I do believe that, like, if you are an unhappy person, getting into a relationship is fraught with peril because if you're not happy with, like, or love yourself, then how in the world can you possibly have a healthy relationship with another person?
Right.
It happens all the time. People do it, you know, because we make unhealthy decisions all the time.
Before
recording this podcast, I ate a 1,400 calorie burrito. That's not good.
Well.
But I do it. I do it because I don't know any better. So, but yeah, I thought it was interesting because, like, that's, you know, he handed her on a silver platter, hey, I will make you a mother again.
Yeah.
With the quote unquote love of your life. And mm-hmm. she turns him down. Now, she asserts that she's happy and he asserts that he's happy too. I think that both of them are lying. But that goes back to this conversation we discussed, you know, that we started early on, that both of these people, they're in a trajectory that's drifting further apart.
I guess. I mean, I think they could certainly be happy together. I think that maybe they just have issues outside of the relationship that they're trying to figure out that are making them unhappy. But maybe in this relationship, they are or certainly could be happy.
Right. And I haven't, you know, because I don't know if I've told this on the podcast before, but there's something a therapist said to me once about, you know, personal growth and development that, you know, you wake up and you find yourself in a deep, dark hole. You don't know how you got in there. You don't know how you got it. You don't know how to get out. You struggle. You finally pull yourself out of the hole. You walk down the street and bam, you fall in the hole again.
Mm-hmm.
And this time you understand better which road, you got there and it's not as big of a struggle. You get out of the hole. You walk down the street and then you fall in the fucking hole again. This time you're a pro. You get out of it expertly. You go to walk down the street and you actually turn left and go down a different street.
Yeah.
That's like the different levels of personal growth. Mm-hmm. And I don't obviously and that most people that are recovering from whatever or trying to better themselves have kind of a similar struggle where, you know, you can't just stop the patterns that you've been sucked into. You can't make the trauma go away. I think that Kevin and Nora keep falling in this hole.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't know is, are they getting better at getting out? And is their turning left going to mean going their separate ways?
Mm-hmm.
Because fundamentally, they're tied together. Like they're what's brought them together is their shared pain and trauma from these events that happened to them.
Yeah,
you know, and it's for very different reasons. Like Nora lost everyone. Kevin lost no one.
Mm-hmm.
But in losing no one, he also lost his family for a time. Like, you know, they're like departure adjacent, I guess.
Yeah.
They finally wake up one morning and be like, you know, the thing that brought us together is this grief and a trauma, and we're not traumatized or grieving anymore, and we don't really have that much in common. Look at you. You're covered with tattoos. I just had the Wu-Tang logo. The Wu-Tang band.
Might have intentions of catching up. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. And that's the thing. That's, like, I can see them parting ways mutually as a emotionally positive thing at the end of this mm-hmm. the series as well.
Honestly, I could. Man, it's hard for me to judge who kind of is maybe closer to avoiding those holes, right?
Yeah,
closer to avoiding the pits. I think Nora is. So far this season, more on the path. Now, well, I think that's going to change when Kevin gets to Australia and does some shit with his dad, most likely, is my guess.
Well, so, I mean, this goes... Some of this is, like, how you choose to look at this evidence. Because one of the things I was struck mm-hmm. by is, you know, Nora's very playful and dismissive about Kevin's book.
Yeah.
And she clearly is, like, you know, the rational hero. She's the one, like, that's against bullshit and woo and rigmarole and all that other mm-hmm. bullshit, flimflam, as James Randi once put it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Kevin, starting to buy his own press.
You think so?
And, you know, pace our conversation about, you know, preseason about, like, what is the rational choice to make here?
Mm-hmm.
To believe in the supernatural because you've seen your, or to, can you know, steadfastly insist, no, this is just a coincidence. I think it's interesting that they themselves, like, Why isn't Laura or Nora? I don't know why I keep doing that. Why is Nora went to Jardin and Miracle on a leap of faith?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't a rational decision.
No.
Why is she steadfastly refusing to admit that, like, hey, this book actually lays out a pretty compelling case for you that there's something special.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that is, but she's like, you know, she just continues to wrap all these conversations up and this irony. And also, I also don't know what Kevin thinks about this because Kevin, you know, he's a guy, he's an actor portraying a person having an emotional reaction. And I think he's pretty transparent to see that he's not good. Mm-hmm. He's not okay with this. He thinks there's something, and Nora just ignores it.
Right.
But I don't know if it's like that's only something that we as the audience are supposed to pick up on or we're supposed to notice that Nora is not noticing it. Do you have any opinions on that?
What I want to see is more of what Kevin is actually doing before I'm going to be sure where he's headed this season, because we don't actually know if he does take this bag off every time, right? I mean, he might be going to the hotel every day, every morning.
Exactly, right. We don't.
We're not sure just how deep this problem goes with him and what he's doing to remedy it. So. Right. I don't know which one is farther along the path toward, you know, maybe some kind of healing, I guess. But they both look to be pretty far from it at this point.
Yeah.
Like Nora is chasing down essentially what is her bag on the head, which is this machine that ionizes you with radiation.
Right.
And then you go to the place where the people, the 2% went. She's doing exactly the same thing Kevin is.
Yeah, Mark, look, you get in this box and you'll just be disintegrated.
Right. And she knows it intellectually,
but
emotionally
yes.
She is chasing this idea
and also,
of motherhood, of,
it's very, it's also
family woman.
Her rational mind is very, it's easy to say, I mean, this is such a story in one episode. Her rational mind is saying, I'm going to stick it to these fuckers. I'm going to expose them, and I'm going to strike a blow for righteousness.
Yeah.
But also, this would be a good opportunity to go see my daughter on the company dime.
Yeah.
Like, there's this going to Australia, yes, she wants to expose this and say, but also, what if it's true?
Right, right.
Which, the other thing, and before we move on from Kevin and Nora, I also think it's interesting that Nora just can see right through Matt's bullshit. Like she says, I can see the lie wheel spinning in your head.
I feel like that's a brother-sister thing, right?
But I also think that she's just a pretty sharp, emotionally perceptive person because
that
as
too.
Matt says, like, when have I ever lied to you? And, you know, obviously this is hyperbole, but she says, well, that one time when I was 4 or 5 and our house was burning down with the parents inside and you said they're already ahead. And he comes back and says they are. Which is interesting because from Matt's perspective, that I believe him. That's not a lie.
Right. He's
so it's
he
possible.
He may be saying things that are false, but he believes them.
Right. And so it's possible that Matt's never told her a lie, but she asserts that she can still tell when he's being dishonest, but she can't pick up on Kevin's very amateur and ham-fisted attempts to conceal emotional truth from her.
Well, that's what I think.
I don't buy it.
That's why I think, you know, the brother-sister relationship here is the thing that really makes or breaks. Because you can always tell with your family members, people you've spent your entire life with, a lot more about them than people you just met along the way, right?
Right.
So, I don't know. Maybe she just doesn't know Kevin well enough.
Right. On the other hand, I also think that it's weird because this is an instance where they both could have come clean with each other because she caught him doing aberrant behavior, and she could have, you know, like, I feel like in the previous season, she goes, well, I just broke my own arm to keep you from seeing his tattoo, and, like, told that story to him, and she can't, I don't know, it feels like something's fundamentally different in their relationship.
I feel like this might be a conversation they have.
Yeah?
It might come out that they either had this conversation off-screen or they're going to, in a future episode, have the conversation, because the natural question here is, what the hell did you get that tattoo for?
Right.
Or not even, like, that interrogative of a tone, but like just inquisitive, right?
No,
Kevin's gonna want to know about the tattoo.
If Cecily came home with a Wu-Tang tattoo on her forearm, I wouldn't be judging. I'd be like, what? I've never known you to be into the Wu-Tang Clan.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Also, did you get it before or after you took the cast off?
Like, right. Yeah.
How long have you had this thing?
Yeah, you're right. We might, you know, and they're gonna be stuck on a plane together for,
right,
what, 18 hours or however.
He's gonna be looking down at her arm. I'm sure it'll come up.
It might come up.
Yeah.
So,
there's a lot more to talk about with Nora here.
I
really want to know exactly what Tom is getting at when he's talking to her in the car. I have a vague idea, but I'm not sure the analogy that he's using is perfect.
I think he's saying is, look, you are flirting with fucking this kid up.
Uh-huh.
Like, you've made your bed for good or ill, and now you need to lie on it. Because going when she's now able to recognize that you're a stranger and this is a weird thing, if you keep that up, like, this, like me having revealed that I had a parent that, you know, was beyond my quote-unquote real parent, fucked me up for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And led to a lot of self-destructive behavior. Don't do that to Lily.
But he specifically mentions, like, I went knocking on a guy's door who wanted nothing to do with me. And that's not the case with Nora. Nora would certainly want something to do with Lily.
That's
why I say it's an imperfect comparison.
Oh, I get what you're saying.
Because, like, she would welcome Lily with open arms, right?
Right, but it's like, and certain aspects, like Christine is that parent to Nora. And also, so it's like interesting. Like, Christine is both Tommy's father and Lily is Tommy. Also, low blow to rename her. I thought that was like,
yeah, that's kind of a fuck you.
Yeah.
Like, she's got a name. She recognizes her name.
But also, I think there's more to this story because Nora told this, like, heroic story of, like, I saw a woman in pain who'd lost her child, and I didn't want to stand, my happiness to stand in her way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is this very emotionally unstable, flighty person in a moment of regret for who knows what reasons are coming back and trying to scam this child for God knows what purpose. Like, and it's also weird that Tommy is kind of like on Christine's side after their experience together.
Yeah. Somehow they've patched things up over the last 3 years. Right.
I get it. Like, she was in a cult. She was very young. She got fucked up. She didn't know what to do. And now she's grown up and regretted those decisions she's made. I just don't.
And so has Tommy. Tommy was in the same boat, right?
And Tommy can, like, have ultimate sympathy for her because he was like one person removed from the situation, even.
Right.
So I wonder if we're going to get more of that through some kind of flashback or some more, you know. I hope we get Erica some more.
Yeah. It was nice to see her. We weren't sure, you know, if she was dead, if she was out of the country, or
right.
But she seems to be living just there in
the neighborhood.
In the neighborhood in Texas there, yeah.
I mean, maybe not in Miracle anymore, but certainly some place with an easy drive of it.
Near Austin?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that whole thing I would like to know more about, because it's just weird that Nora's such a fighter. I mean, what she said, because here's the other thing, is like we were introduced to her as this person who's this heroically persevering through all this loss.
Mm-hmm.
She is a defender of justice and truth in the Department of Sudden Departures. She tells her inspiring story to help other people feel good. But then we know in her personal life, she acts out by, you know, breaking things in public and having people be sympathetic and having a prostitute shoot her in the chest with a handgun.
Right.
Like, this again, like, the fact that she's put on this mask of, like, oh, I'm the selfless martyr, I wonder what that's hiding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also interesting that she, or telling, I guess, into what she's thinking when she takes the picture of this pillar guy, this dead pillar guy, places it over this, you know, Jesus Christ-like imagery of him out in the square there.
I love that painting.
Of which hit, one?
Of the pillar
guy
man
in the robes
being,
with
being
the flowing
raptured.
Beard.
Yeah.
No, it's pretty sweet. She feels like it's sort of falsely co-opting her experience. You know, like these people who have not actually lost anyone are trying to get in on like her monopoly, right? Her claim to fame, or not even her claim to fame, because I don't think she likes this fact. But
she hates people that can't cope with what she perceives as less of an emotional load than she does.
Right, and it ties in with what Erica said.
Like,
right,
that drives Erica, her fucking crazy to fraudulently get sympathy, to fraudulently be a martyr,
especially as it relates to the departure, because she has had
that's holy
the most
her.
Significant experience with that.
Yes,
but it goes right back to what Erica was telling her. Look, the reason I'm not going insane about Evie is because I got closure.
Right.
I got to bury her. I know what happened to her. You have no idea, Nora. And that's like far worse than just having someone die.
Right.
Is just having someone disappear and not knowing anything about it.
Yeah. How do you score the fight between her and Tommy? Tommy tries to relate, I think, gently, like give her guidance for, you know, like, I understand what you're doing, but think of it from Lidler's perspective, think of it from Christine's perspective, think about if this is healthy from you. And he's like, you know, I can just say, like, I just wish that, you know, my mom and dad had never told me about my quote-unquote real father. And she goes, well, I wish you never left me, Lily, for me to find. And he comes back with the fatality. He says, I didn't leave her for you, Nora. I left her for my father. I didn't even know you existed.
Yeah.
And I walked away. And you could tell that like really landed home to Nora. Did you think that was exceptionally vicious of Tommy? Was that him trying to straight talk her to help her? Was that...
It's tough to tell.
I mean, that... that's a crack in this weird family that I didn't like seeing.
Yeah.
Just because, like, you know, it feels like... Yeah, and that, I just... You know, I selfishly, if I wrote these dramas, everyone would get along and everyone would be happy and support each other, and it'd be super fucking boring. So I'm glad I'm not writing it, but that's kind of what I want, and they're not doing that. I felt like that was maybe, it's another instance where Tommy is too traumatized to relate. He tried to relate to someone, and they threw it back in his face, and he's like, oh yeah, well fuck. Like if Tommy is trying to achieve an objective, he betrays it by twisting the knife. But he can't help it because he's too close to the thing as well.
Right. Yeah. It's almost sad in that way. Just that these are two broken people working with their own issues and not helping each other in any way because of it.
Right.
It's rough. I got to say, though, if you're Kevin and someone's going to walk in on you asphyxiating yourself... Nora's the perfect person for this to happen with, right? 100% perfect. She is the one who you don't have to say a goddamn word. She gets it.
She doesn't judge you. She accepts. Like, and that's,
she understands. She's done this exact same thing.
And I'm fairly sure early on last season, I was exasperated with Kevin because why are you hiding things from this woman?
Right.
Like, it's one thing. Like, it's kind of like one thing if. You know that she disapproves or she's going to judge you or she's not going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that's always that's a sign of a good relationship when you've got a partner that accepts and embraces you for the weird shit, you know? Like, it's she's not in love with this idolized version of you. She's in love with the real person, and you're fucking throwing that away by hiding things from her.
Yeah, and I think Kevin here is really the person keeping her at arm's length a lot of the time because...
Yes, I agree. Although I do feel like from getting Nora's perspective, maybe she's doing a little bit of that to him.
Maybe a little, but I really feel like she is willing to open up to some people. Like she opens up to Erica, right? They've clearly formed a bond that is stronger, I'd say, than the one that Kevin and Nora currently have.
Okay.
And I blame that mostly on Kevin because he's been hiding so much from her.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like he's intentionally hiding things, whereas Nora is conflicted even internally about mm-hmm. how she feels, and so she doesn't even know that there are things that she should say to Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Or if she knows that there's something she should say, she doesn't know what it is. Whereas Kevin knows. Kevin could say, "I'm seeing Patty."
Yeah.
I'm putting in my waking life. Yeah. I'm killing myself potentially every morning.
Did you think on the second or third time I watched this, there's this throwaway conversation. I think I only noticed it because I had closed captions put on at this point. But as they're taking the elevator lift up to the man's pillar and doing his personal effects collection, uh-huh. they have this conversation about how Kevin needs three hampers.
Right.
I need one
for his gym clothes,
one for my dry cleaning, and one for like this. But I wondered if that was Kevin's way of trying to talk about this, because it seems like this is somehow tied into his need to continue to get I interpret it as somehow this is going to step up his supply of bags to tie around his head.
Okay,
you know, it's like this is some kind of justification for I'm really meticulous about my laundry and maybe a cry for help.
Okay,
does that make any sense to you?
Sure, you see that? I like it. Okay. It's a good theory. It's as good as any I've seen.
I mean, on the other end, he's got legitimate laundry needs.
That's true. I mean, how many pants has he just soiled with shit when he kills himself every morning?
Sure,
right?
Sure. Or he gets buried in mud, or he gets in river mud or whatever the hell, reservoir mud. Yeah, uh-huh. It's not good. Frequently shot, covered in blood. That's mm-hmm. you know that stuff. That's dry cleaner work right there. Before we move on from that subject, what do we make of the Pillar Man having essentially a Bible and a picture of a killer whale?
I have no idea. This was bizarre to me.
I have an idea that this is thematically setting up things with Kevin or with Nora and Matt, that Matt feels very close to this woman who has done what she can to support this person mm-hmm. who is insupportable in a very clear way that, like, you know, him and Mary's relationship, and that he's the most important thing in her life. But there's no pictures of her up there. It's just a picture of him and a whale. Like,
mm-hmm.
he never acknowledged or that sacrifice meant anything to him.
Yeah.
In a similar way to Mary being resentful of Matt, trying to cash in on his years of service to her and using her and her kid as a prop or whatever. I think that's an odd and simplistic reading of the situation, but that's her words. Do you think that we're supposed to deliberately draw a parallel there to see that, like, you know, ultimately Matt put so much emphasis on this to an off-putting degree, and you got mm-hmm. the same situation. You find out that this guy didn't appreciate what his wife was doing at all.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that could be. I wonder, I mean, Matt certainly doesn't know that, right? So he would see a lot of sympathy, have a lot of sympathy for this woman.
They're also connected with this because, you remember, in the first season, there was a lot of Job imagery with Matt. Mm-hmm. And last season, you know, Brett Butler character was just this preacher out in the slum city that they had run around outside Miracle,
mm-hmm.
everyone trying to get back in. Matt went to her for a loan because he was desperate to, you know, have a mule or a coyote get him into Jardin.
Yeah.
And she puts him through a couple of paces about to test his Bible knowledge. And one of the last questions she asked him is, what was Job's wife's name?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, she's never named, but she said to, you know, if you still have integrity, curse God and die.
Mm-hmm.
What do we make of that now that we know that this is a Job, this is essentially a wife of Job type figure?
Right.
Because she, you know, that I always thought that, like, the biblical Job's wife was not exactly supportive. She's like, you've had your kids killed, you've had your crops destroyed, you've had your houses destroyed, and now you've been afflicted with a painful disease, probably terminal. Like, why do you still praise God? Go ahead and tell him to go to hell so he'll kill you.
I mean, I think she was pretty tolerant of the whole situation.
Yeah.
She waited a long time to say that, but
yeah, you're right. It wasn't like the first time the windstorm came and knocked his house down, killed all of his kids.
Yeah.
Like, all right, we'll give that one to God.
We'll roll with the punches.
Yeah, yeah.
I still believe, right. But, you know, once you have all these bad things happen, people who aren't quite as fervent change their mind.
All right.
I don't know. It's clear that, Matt just identifies with this woman deeply and is trying to help her. I don't know where we're going with that, but we'll see.
Shall we talk a little, do a deep dive on, you know, some of the stuff that came out in the Mark Lynn Baker conversation?
Okay.
First, thematically, he throws her phone in the toilet and says, relax, it's just hardware. Everything important is up in the cloud.
Right.
I mean, that...
Yeah,
that is
a reference to your body.
Yeah,
just being hardware.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep. Everything matters is up in the clouds. He talks a mess about radiation, and I don't think the science of this is important, except for the acronym for the low amplitude Denziger radiation is ladder. Mm-hmm. And if we're thinking of biblical references, there's the vision that Jacob had of a ladder going up to heaven and angels coming up and angels going down. Jacob's ladder. Everyone's heard of that. Do you think that is... Am I reading too much into that, or is that an intentional, you know, like a bridge? Like, this is literally a bridge to another realm, to a heavenly realm. No, I'm going to say, fine, I don't care about your
prediction.
Opinion.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to. Yeah.
And I'm going to say official prediction.
Uh-huh.
The guy running this is going to be named Jacob.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of on the nose.
Maybe Jacob. Maybe he'll be Jewish. I don't know.
So the other thing I think is interesting, if you take, does Nora look old in that flash forward, or does she look like a woman who's been blasted with some crazy radiation that went wrong? Because you think of her being a Lynn.
How do you distinguish
this,
the two?
Well, you don't, but I'm just saying, like, this is a new kind of, like, possibilities open up to us, mm-hmm. because you put together the Lynn's theory, you put together all this mechanical and electronic malfunction around her. Especially when she's exercising her free will to go places.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see some crazy ass thing where she's the sole survivor. Everyone else in the room is killed. And her response to that is also the other thing that made me think about is, like, there's this another biblical story where Moses asked to see God.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, I can't show myself to you because
you would
literally be blasted apart like fucking Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark style.
Uh-huh.
Like, you'd be blown apart. I can show you a portion of my glory. So
he whips it out.
So, like, Moses hid in the cave and God's glory passes in front of the cave and it fucking irradiates Moses. He comes down from this experience. His hair is now white. His face is shining and like described as maybe like it's like burnt and healed over, or mm-hmm. also literal interpretation is it's literally shining like the Sylvania Man. But it's kind of like, if you read the description, it kind of matches what Nora looks like in that flash forward.
Yeah.
I wonder if that is yet another piece of biblical imagery that's going to be like, this is going to be a haywire microwave experience, that she's going to be the sole survivor. And she's like, you know what? Fuck all this. I'm going to go deliver pigeons and nuns in Australia.
Yeah. No, I mean, this could be part of her new identity, right?
Mm.
That she is desperately seeking.
Well, plus, you know, Nora's got this mythology building up around her. She's the fucking demon Azrael. She's a Lynn. She's did mm-hmm. all this stuff. But she's just overshadowed by Kevin.
Yeah, and they take it in kind of the opposite direction here, right? Nora cursed.
Yes.
And Kevin would be blessed, right? Like,
Kevin is messianic. Nora is demonic.
Right.
Kevin is trying to go easy on people and be like, you know, everybody, it's that old saying, it's like, everybody's got a great burden, kind of be kind to each other. Mm-hmm. Nora's like, no, fuck this. This is what really happened to this guy. Suck it.
Right.
So there is like an evil, benign kind of tension to the relationship with, you know, everybody else in the world.
Yeah, and I wonder if they're going to push them intentionally in those opposite directions,
mm-hmm.
and to what end? Like, could we see essentially what amounts to a battle between the two?
Yeah,
you know, over like the fate of the world,
sure.
or some perceived fate of the world.
Sure. When Kevin gets anointed with the Holy Spirit and Nora takes on the mantle of Azrael, there'll be this right. like Highlander-like battle.
What I kind of mean
with
is
electricity sparkling between the two.
More
it's
mundane
essentially,
than that.
It's essentially the season finale of Legion.
Yeah, basically. No, it'll probably be more mundane. Like, Kevin wants to go do this thing with his dad in Australia, and he believes that it'll save the world.
Yeah.
Nora, in her rational thinking, says, you're fucking insane, and
right.
is trying to prevent him from doing it.
Right.
I can see something like that playing out.
It is funny that Kevin's not the one going to Australia.
Yeah.
It's Nora, but he's, you know, obviously he knows his dad is there and living off the grid. It's kind of
like... Yeah, he didn't want to go to St. Louis.
the same way that she used St. Louis as a pretext. A pretty flimsy one, because St. Louis is not all that close to Kentucky.
Was it in Kentucky?
Yeah. It was Eminence, Kentucky.
So many Eminences in
there
the
Midwest. There are. None of them particularly great.
No.
It's funny, because like all these, like in the flyover country... You take pride in being from a small town, because there's always a smaller town you can talk shit about.
Right.
Like, I grew up in Mooresville. Like, Martinsville talks shit about Mooresville. Mooresville talks shit about Monrovia. Monrovia talks shit about Eminence. I think that's where it starts. Like, if you're in Eminence, you're like, yeah, we're kind of a shithole. There's only a few. Yeah, it's crazy. I think at some point you get all the way down. It's like, this is the lowest caste of people. They just,
but then you can go
the
to, like, state pride, right? Which you can go, well, Indiana's bigger than Rhode Island.
Yeah, I'm from Eminence, but
Islanders.
At least I'm not from fucking Kentucky. Or Michigan, right. Right.
But to your point, yeah, I mean, Kevin is definitely using this as a pretense to get to Australia.
Seems like it.
Hopefully meet up with his dad.
Yeah, but I think that's also, if you're writing a book about him, that's an interesting detail, that he's like, not of his own will, was he thus conveyed to Australia, you know, whatever.
Right. I do really love Nora's, like, playful shit about Kevin being like, and thus she did kiss the lips of Kevin.
And Lo,
like,
it was good. Right. Well, and then when
all of
I'm not
stuff,
ready to
hilarious.
Get there, but also just to your point, it does seem like Matt has written the book of Kevin in his very florid biblical language.
Right.
Like, he raised his hand unto them and they did not respond. Yea, verily, he clasped the stone to his chest and jumped into the water.
Seems
like,
perfectly natural.
I think I put a bit more spin onto it, but it does seem like he has... You know, he's writing what he knows.
Mm-hmm.
Nora circumventing the smoke alarm. Anything there to talk about?
No, I mean, she doesn't want to be reminded of this coping mechanism she's using, I guess.
I
could read into it that way.
Yeah. Well, but
or
she
just doesn't want the hit on her credit card when they find out that she's been smoking.
Oh, they're going to know.
They'll smell it.
They're going to fucking know as soon as they open the doors. Like, someone smoked a cigarette in there.
Yeah.
Like, it's
6 months ago, but we smell it.
Yeah. No,
it's in there.
I don't know what it is about cigarette smoke that's so fucking pungent, but it goddamn is.
Yeah.
But I thought that was interesting that she, in an episode loaded with technological measures being circumvented by her. Mm-hmm. Through no volition of her own, that she herself disabled a technological measure. I don't know what there is there or what's there there. Can we talk about Nora and Erica? Erica seems fine, and she attributes it to, and this is, seems to be like a recurring theme, that the reason the people in departure can't get closures because they're, you know, we can't observe any of the Judeo-Christian or, you know, whatever burial customs we have for our people. Like, they're just that this is a, it's like a missing, it's a difference between a missing person and a dead person. Erica says, I got to bury my little girl, you didn't.
Yeah, I don't know if it's tied specifically to the act of burial, but just like knowing what happened to them.
Yeah. Because that's the thing, like, maybe that's what it is. She wasn't saying so much, I got to do the custom, and that's like, although I do think there is. I mean, I'm a weirdo and I don't like, I feel like all burial customs are all kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Like the idea that we put people in plush boxes inside of concrete vault and preserve them to maintain their body integrity for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Seems like a fucking contradiction of the natural world and it creeps me the fuck out.
Yeah.
So,
no reason to do it.
A lot of people derive a lot of comfort from those things. Sure. I'm just one of the weirdos. It's like, no, like I, you know, if you can just bury me in a hole, that'd probably be ideal. Otherwise, cremation. But yeah, I guess knowing, you know, the difference between a dead person and a missing person is the missing person, you're always, I think Nora articulated this, you're always waiting for them to walk through the door.
Yeah.
Dead person, you know, and you can get closure and move on. Trampoline. It was a great visual.
Mm-hmm.
And slow motion trampolining to Wu-Tang's Protect Your Neck, also subtitled The Jump Off. Is there anything to talk about there, or is that just a neat, is Nora going to purchase a trampoline? Trampoline therapy real?
Going to get to Australia, purchase a patch of land just for trampolines.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't know. Trampoline therapy, I think, only works because...
She's going to see kangaroos, and they're bouncing around. They're obviously so happy, and
that's
she turns a blind eye to the hidden tragedy of kangaroos on the highway and decides she's going to build a cult around bouncing. It's the cult of Tigger.
No, I think she's so happy because she's with Erica.
Yeah.
And Erica seems to be a positive force in her life.
And jumping on trampolines is crazy fun.
It is fun. Yeah.
Late last year, my son talked me into taking him to a Sky Zone.
Yeah.
And at first, I'm like, well, I'll get you a ticket. I'll just watch it, buddy. And 5 minutes, I'm like, no, fuck that. Here's my money. Give me the orange socks. I'm bouncing. And it was a hell of a lot of fun. A hell of a lot of fun. So do we have anything else to talk about other than the climax of the episode?
No, let's get to that.
Okay. We're in Australia. Mm-hmm. We are following a chief, Kevin.
Chief of police named Kevin.
Unknown his last name, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
He has a license plate, ZCU666. Get the fuck out of here. Get the fuck out of here, number one. He runs over one of the acolytes of the bounce, the kangaroo, puts it out of his misery. He goes back to the police department and busts the balls of a deputy.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't understand where that fits into this story.
Right.
It seems to be inconsequential.
Well, I mean, because I'm sitting here racking my brain trying to figure out what the hell does this mean. And the thing that I can come across is obviously the deputy thinks he's doing nothing wrong. This is maybe something that they do in this small town in Australia. They just like, hey, nothing's going to happen tonight. Fuck off. We're going to fuck off. And it seemed like the chief's overreaction to this is out of character.
Right.
So maybe the chief is going through some shit. Maybe we'll find out what it is. Maybe we won't. Him running over to kangaroo is like something that stressed him out or pissed him off or reminded him of it. He takes it out on the deputy, and then the four horsewomen of the apocalypse drown him.
Mm-hmm.
And because they think he's the Kevin of the Book of Kevin.
I mean, talk about, you know, coincidental timing.
Yeah.
We just watched Wicker Man yesterday. Which you said one of the worst possible ways to die in your mind is being killed for a cause that you don't believe in.
Or understand. Or,
By fanatics. And that's exactly what happens here yet again.
You're right. Again, the show's made just for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys are doing watching it and listening to it, but it's clearly made for what the hell? Drunken Desperado,
right?
Everybody else, it's just collateral joy, I guess. So they dart him, they knock him out, they tie him up to a teeter totter and submerge him until he drowns. They bring him back up, and I feel like if they wanted to, they could have resuscitated him, because a drowned person, I've always heard, is pretty easy. Like if you put some air into their lungs, they'll come back.
Uh-huh.
Because they're not really dead yet. They're just unconscious. Mm. And what was crazy about it is these women that went for, you know, certainty that this was that he's going to come back to life, to kind of panic. And in the middle of it, Kevin Sr. comes out.
Right. So
what the hell is going on in this situation?
He doesn't seem to know these people. Now, it may turn out that he does, and this is like some wry greeting.
What kind of weird coincidence would it be for these people to pick his home or place he's staying to drown this guy, Kevin?
And how did he not know about it? Does he have this seesaw to the lake, to the pond, just there at all times? Like, what is he doing with kangaroos?
I don't know.
Is he drowning kangaroos?
Let me ask you this.
Why is this built in his front yard, and how does he not know about it if he didn't build it?
I don't know. So the other possibility is this is still the chief's house, and Kevin Sr. was staying with this other Kevin? I'm just saying, like, all the different possibilities. So there's possibility A is this is a coincidence. These women took this guy to this place to test kill him and bring him back to life, and Kevin Sr.'s happened to be there. Mm-hmm. Other possibility is Kevin Sr. staying there, and these are kind of acolytes of his, which explains why they might be ahead of the curve on the Book of Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe this is something that Matt is secretly sharing, because they've had... Matt and him have had this kind of clandestine connection. Because remember, the chief buried the money for him before he went off, and like, you know, they've had this relationship. and this is all related, and I don't know what he's going to do when he comes out. Or the second opera is that this is at the sheriff's house, and Kevin is there related to the fact that this is a chief that's Kevin, and he's a chief that's Kevin, and his son's a chief that's Kevin, and the women are just kind of interlopers in it all.
Yeah, maybe he...
There's probably other possibilities, but...
I mean, he might be there with a purpose, and they might not know he's there. So if Kevin is for some reason... Because we've seen in the previews that later on, Kevin Sr. is going to be drowning Kevin Jr. in the bathtub, right?
Right.
Presumably to prevent whatever perceived apocalypse is going to happen on the 14th.
To prevent Azrael from absconding with Nora's body, surely.
Right.
The only possibility.
Is it possible that Kevin is looking for other Kevins who might also fit the prophecy?
I mean...
And fulfill the conditions?
So we know Kevin Sr. is, by most definitions of the word, crazy.
Okay, yeah.
And he hears people, and he feels more sane when he gives in to what the voices are telling him to do.
Yeah.
So I could totally see him... finding that there is this chief of police in this obscure small town and being fixated with that.
Right.
That feeding into his delusion.
Especially if there's some kind of, you know, negative axis mundi or like some kind of, you know, pole where one side of the earth has it, the other side of the earth has it. I think we did like some GPS scoping and it wouldn't actually work out.
No.
But... Yeah, maybe he's there for a reason, and maybe they don't know about it
yet. There's also that guy from Australia in Perth that survived some kind of earthquake and a collapse of some sort.
Right, right.
Roughly at the same time that Kevin survived, the earthquake saved Kevin's life.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that will tie back in. The question I have for you, has any time in the last 3 years Kevin called his old man and said, "Hey, Dad, you contacted me through smoke signals in this international assassin hotel."
Right.
Did that happen? Like, were you aware? Like, cause that to me, that's a burning. If I'm Kevin and I have any curiosity intellectually at all, and maybe he's afraid of the answer, but I'm finding out from my dad, like, do you remember this happening? Is there any kind of, and if he says, "No, I don't remember at all," then like, you can be like, "Okay, well, this is just me then."
Right.
But for them to have that weird connection, I don't know. I thought that was interesting, and the fact that Kevin never followed up on it almost beggars my belief.
Is it possible that the reason he's suffocating himself is to communicate with his dad?
It's possible. We don't know. Like, most of what he told Nora in this episode is a pack of lies. So why would he tell the truth when he goes, "I always rip it off before it's too late. I don't want to die."
I don't buy it.
I don't buy it either.
Yeah.
I don't think he wants to die like in a permanent
sense. He wants to use his ability in some way.
So here's a piece of evidence that is confusing. Mm-hmm. When Dean the dog man came after Kevin with the gun, I read Kevin as being very afraid of dying.
Yeah.
If he is killing himself ritually every day, why would he be afraid of that?
It's a good question.
That kind of leads a little credence to him. Maybe he wants to die. Maybe he wants that to happen. Mm-hmm. He wants to explore the hotel. But, you know, the human inborn desire to not self-terminate just overrides it. And he always rips. Like, he's telling her the truth. "I always rip it off before it's too late."
Mm-hmm.
But in his mind, that's a failure, not him doing things correctly. Like, if he wants to, like, take that ride. He's just too afraid to.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why his dad has to be the one that drowns him. Because that puts that conversation from the trailer into context when he says, "You're going to have to hold me down. Because if left to my own devices, I will always chicken out."
Uh-huh.
Now they don't have Patty. Now they don't have Patty as a source of strength.
Yeah. I mean, he has tried to actively kill himself before. He jumped into that river.
But that was when he was sleepwalking under the influence of Patty. Like, has Kevin...
No, not that final time.
Yeah, the only time that Kevin has chosen to die is when he drank the poison.
Right.
So...
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I don't have any real theories. I'm just trying to lay out all the information so that we can, as we're watching, nobody's left behind.
No, I'm pretty sure we'll see more about it.
Okay.
We'll get more insight into that relatively soon.
What else? ZCU 666. We already talked about that. I just want to emphasize it. What else? Is there anything else that we haven't talked about? Oh, Freddie Rumsen in this episode.
Oh, yeah.
I knew that because he's shown up before in a minor role. Freddie Rumsen is a guy who is a character from Mad Men. I don't know the actor's actual name. Mm-hmm. But he shows up here as Nora's direct report, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe the guy that just manages her expense account? I don't know.
Some guy at the DSD, for sure.
Right, right. So I think that's all I have to talk about. I have a ton of feedback. Do you have anything else you want to talk about?
I have one last question for you.
All right, I'm ready. I'm braced.
Can the holy balls be busted?
Will we find out?
Probably the best line of the episode. I loved it.
So, like, you know, the other thing about, I guess there is one more thing to talk about, because you remember yesterday I talked about Sarah, or last week I talked about the biblical Sarah.
Yeah.
She was renamed Sarah when she preposterously and inconceivably conceived a child, who later became the father of Israel, literally.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin now says to her, we should have a baby together. That seems to really lean into that interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to throw it out there.
Okay. Well, of course, more needs to develop on that front, but yeah.
And maybe that's like her destiny that she's running away from, because she's the demon Azrael and she's not holy at all.
Right.
But it's also interesting if, like, what if they try and they're one or the other is infertile, or maybe both.
What if she gets blasted by radiation and becomes infertile?
I was getting to, like, maybe his holy balls are, in fact, already busted.
maybe.
No, you get blasted with radiation. Like, you know, we talked about some of the things of that, but, like, absolutely one of the things that would happen is you'd probably be infertile.
Yeah.
I mean, that's shit the Nazis did when they're sterilizing people. So.
Right.
Not only would you look like you were 90 years old, but you would not be able to bear children. Hey, we talked up in the housekeeping section about how packed our weeks are here at baldmove.com. And the reason we're able to produce so much content is because the generosity of our fans supporting us through Club Bald Move at club.baldmove.com. You can sign up for a low monthly or save on quarterly or yearly subscriptions, and you get a lot of mileage in return. Number one, the satisfaction of knowing you're helping keeping this enterprise afloat. Number two, you get a lot of bonus features like ad-free feeds, so you never have to listen to these ads or the other paid product placement stuff that we do. You also have access to our weekly variety show, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. You get the spoiler-filled movie takes or first-run movie takes. You get access to special features like Quip and our video game playthroughs that we do exclusively for club members. Tons of stuff, and you can get previews for a lot of that stuff if you go to the club page at club.baldmove.com. So check it out. We appreciate your support. We couldn't do it without those generously financially supporting us. And if that sounds like something you'd like to get into, check it out, club.baldmove.com. If you'd like to send feedback, you can do so, leftovers@baldmove.com, for consideration. Got a lot of email, a lot of stuff on similar topics, and a lot that we just don't have time to read. Try to do my best as the editor here to select some good ones. Sarah M. Interesting. Sarah.
Oh,
have you
boy.
Birthed any nation, Sarah? Simeon Stylites was a 4th century fella. This is background about the Pillar Man, because we talked about we're not sure if there's any, you know, what's the deal with him standing on the pillar.
Mm-hmm.
So 4th century fella from what is now known as Turkey. At a young age, he became obsessed with Christianity. He entered a monastery as a young man, but was deemed too ascetic for communal life, so they booted him out. He was too Christian for Christians. He then locked himself away in a hut and was known for passing the whole of Lent without eating or drinking. Holy shit, 40 days without eating or drinking?
Is that even possible?
I know for a fact you cannot go 40 days without drinking.
Right.
Maybe he was licking dew or something. Or maybe he was just cheating.
Very humid where he was.
Folks started to regard him as miraculous. He then started standing upright as long as his limbs would hold him. Eventually, because pilgrims and followers wanted a piece of him and he just wanted to be closer to God, he climbed atop a pillar that was left over from the ruins of the Roman Empire. He figured if he could not leave the world horizontally, he would vertically separate.
Good call.
Yeah.
You know, you now get on the Z-axis
and
see what happens.
Jesus said separate yourself from the world. Yeah. You can't really do that moving horizontally.
What about like a 45?
45?
Just a 45 degree. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Get both. Get both happening.
It's less efficient than going straight up.
Get a posturpedic.
What
I'm trying to say is get bent.
Get bent.
Yeah.
So they say that he would get sustenance from children who would climb up to feed him, or possibly using a bucket and pulley system similar to our mysterious friend in Leftovers.
Hmm.
Later, he became more willing to engage in with his followers and disciples as long as he could do it from a pillar. He would take his audience with folks who would climb up, send letters to his followers about the way to live their life. There are some remnants of these letters still, apparently. Our friend in the pillar in Jardin also wrote letters to a man in Australia, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's some background about the pillar guy. I feel pretty strongly that they probably got that from their friend Reza. And I don't know to what end, especially now that the Pillar Man's dead. But it'll be interesting to see if any of this stuff kind of pays off.
Is that why David Blaine does the stuff he does?
I don't know. Apparently, she also said that that's kind of any kind of aesthetic person who lives in a pillar or like a high place is called a stylite.
Okay.
Named after this guy.
Yeah.
So there you go. So David Blaine would be a modern stylite, I suppose.
Yeah.
Andrew B, can we call the followers of Kevin the Kevinth Day Adventists? I say like we fast track that, we push it through committee, and all in favor say aye. I believe the ayes have it.
Aye.
Kevinth Day Adventists, done and done. Eric L, I've been rereading the book Zealot by Reza Aslan, who, as we know, is a consulting producer on The Leftovers. I thought I'd share a little context it gives on the weirdness of truth in biblical literature. By the way, I also know that Reza Aslan is somewhat a controversial figure,
right,
especially amongst internet folk. I don't care. You can listen to our podcast last year if you want to debate whether he's a jackass or he's a charlatan or whether Sam Harris is the worst person ever. Don't have any dog in that fight.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in his book, he says a lot of the New Testament is written as much as a century after the fact, likely by committee. This email was spawned by me saying that, you know, the biblical Matthew just wrote down what he observed about Jesus.
Right.
Which is not, of course, literally true. These were written down as much as a century after the fact, likely by committee, and is very clearly not factual nor meant to be. Jesus' trial before Pontius Pilate, for example, is almost certainly made up to make the history of Jesus more palatable to a Roman audience by absolving the Romans of guilt. Historical records, Aslan notes, showed that Pilate sentenced countless Jews to death without a worry or thought, much less an introspection or trial. Furthermore, there's no historical evidence for any Passover tradition that allowed prisoners to be released, as they do the whole Barabbas thing in the Bible. This non-fact wouldn't have been seen as a deception by readers at the time, though, as Aslan continues to explain. The relationship between facts and capital T truth was much looser back then. Back then? I think that's something coming back into style.
Yeah.
The facts of the story that Jesus did almost certainly not get any sort of trial aren't as important as the capital T truth that the modified story conveys, that Jesus is the Messiah. With that in mind, the new book of Matthew about Kevin is probably distinctly unlike ancient biblical texts because Matt is likely being clearer with his facts than any ancient writer would be. He's also writing about Kevin as it happens, ostensibly to record the actual happenings as opposed to writing after the fact in order to tell a greater truth with the facts aside. Who knows what's actually in that book, though, and I wonder if the show will use it to grapple with the question of facts versus capital T truth. All those, I think, are pretty much secularly true. It's not, I mean, Luke and Mark were not even an apostle of Jesus. Matthew, you know, the book of Matthew claims to be the historical account of the apostle Matthew. John claims to be the account of the actual apostle John. But even John, I think, was written like when he was almost, like in his 90s. He's really fucking old and he wrote it. Isn't that one of the ones he wrote from prison?
I don't know.
Revelation was.
Yeah.
So anyway, I thought that was interesting, the distinction between the biblical Matthew and the current Matt. Chrissy, this episode went a long way towards clarifying some broad themes for me. I'm already really feeling the idea of Kevin and Nora as perfect strangers, as corny as that sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Outwardly, they seem to have a healthy, happy relationship, and I do not think that has been faked or manufactured in any way by either of them. After all, opposites do attract. However, more than one thing can be true. They're also quite clearly dealing with some shit. Kevin recovering from the Patty of it all, the experiences he has been through, and now the Book of Kevin, all of which are leading him down a path of faith. Nora, on the opposite end of the spectrum, only finds small solace in the instances of science and logic she can hang her hat on. Debunking fake departures and now potentially a scientific explanation for the departure, these forces are clearly pulling the two characters in opposite directions.
Yeah.
I believe this will all come to a head in Australia as Kevin encounters his first set of followers and Nora her physicist saviors. And frankly, because, as we know, the crazy meter is always on tilt in Australia. Hey, taking a shot at the lawless land of Australia.
Yep.
that probably will be popular.
Yeah, I mean we've, you know, we stole a lot of thunder from this guy, not just the Perfect Strangers thing.
We drank a lot of milk. It was a milkshake.
We sure did. Sorry about that.
I mean,
obviously, then we agree on all points.
I feel him on this coming to a head because You're right. Nora's going to have a showdown with these, you know, real life explanation of the departure people.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin is going to, it seems like, undoubtedly come across acolytes of his, if nothing else, his father.
Yeah.
And Kevin's going to have probably experiences that feed into what he's already kind of feeling. And I feel like that Nora, if she continues her trajectory, this is going to be another disappointment. Like, you know, if my wildest thoughts come true, she's going to get blasted with radiation that kills a whole laboratory full of people. She'll be the sole survivor. That's pretty hitting rock bottom as far as a rationalist goes.
I mean, the one image that we have of her that makes me, you know, say, is when she's getting into that box full of styrofoam peanuts. I don't know if she's being shipped somewhere to maybe this, you know, undesignated location or something, and she's not able to see it, and so they pack her away and drive her there.
Right.
Or if she, like, this is part of the procedure, and maybe she's going through with it. There's a lot of things it could be, and I don't want to speculate too much about it, but clearly she's going to follow some sort of thread down this rabbit hole, right?
Yeah, I mean, the packing peanuts is what's weird because surely that's not a procedure.
Right. You wouldn't think so.
To be vapor. Like, you have to be suspended in styrofoam peanuts for the
radiation. I mean, is it any weirder than anything else?
And that's the thing, like, with this kind of pseudoscience thing, like, who the hell knows?
Yeah.
And Mark Lynn Baker's a smart guy, but he's also clearly dealing with some shit that would impair his judgment. So, yeah, I don't know. I had something else I wanted to ask. And it's done left my memory banks, so maybe I'll think of it later. Barry C., after today's episode, can you think of another instance where a celebrity played themselves in a significant role in a major drama and was not just a walk-on role? The only other instance I can think of was Jon Favreau playing himself in The Sopranos and quite a significant role. Neil Patrick Harris in, what was it? Was it Dude Who Stole My Car? Was it Harold and Kumar's?
Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that.
That was, I think there are a bunch of them.
But, I mean, I think he's got a point about actual consequence through the plot, because most of those things are stunt casting. It's a joke. You're not really intended to think that they're playing a version of themselves. And Mark Lynn Baker did a lot of press where he did interviews with people. I'm sure, You know, it's kind of fun for him to go and, you know, his career unexpectedly be resurrected in this way.
Yeah.
But it's funny how he mentioned that it is kind of rare to be asked, because he's not playing himself, right? He's playing a theoretical version of himself if he went through the departure and had this emotional experience with it. And it's funny because he really resisted people like speculation about, like, you know, was this what you would really do? And he's like, it's irrelevant because this is what, you know, Damon Lindelof and Tom Perrotta have me doing in this version of this history. So, like, What I think or feel about the matter is, other than being a fan of the work, is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Lynn Baker is now a character in The Leftovers. He's not a real person in The Leftovers.
Right.
He's just a character that happened to exist at that point in the real world.
Right.
You know, like, he's I guess a departure from the true person Mark Lynn Baker at the moment that the like Perfect Strangers ended, right?
Right.
And I think after that it becomes a character.
It's funny though, because it is interesting when you see people, like when you see celebrities doing cameos, it's usually like Patrick Stewart or Liam Neeson on Ricky Gervais's show, where they're doing like an oddball take on their public persona.
Right.
And, you know, playing against type to get a humorous effect, or they're showing up as their public persona. Because, you know, like, what is Patrick Stewart like really?
Right.
like only his really close friends and family would ever be able to tell you. There's a Patrick Stewart you see at the conventions and doing, you know, Enterprise commercials and all this other stuff. But that's not Patrick. That's not Patrick Stewart the man either.
Yeah, it's a version of
him. That's the public character that he chooses to play.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's super interesting. Aaron C. All I have to say is that they don't play the theme music from National Lampoon's Vacation for Episode 3's opening. I'll be sorely disappointed. So I'm not a big fan of National Lampoon's Vacation. The next episode title is called Crazy White Fella Thinking. I'm assuming that's some kind of National Lampoon reference.
Yeah, I'm not.
It's lost on me.
Me too.
Do you think that the rest of this season's intros will be as tightly coupled with the title and the theme music as this one was? Because I almost feel like Damon Lindelof would avoid that kind of thing.
Yeah, if I were writing this, I would intentionally not do it again.
Right.
I would do it once so it has the impact, and then, you know, it loses the impact with repetition.
Right. But then, you know, some guys like Vince Gilligan lean into that shit.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the first season of first season of Better Call Saul, like everything ended in an O.
Right.
5-0, Nacho, all that kind of crap.
And then occasionally it comes back and it bites him in the ass. Like, I don't know. Me, personally, my taste would have it being done once and then moving on to something else and keeping it fresh.
Because it's no longer a surprise. If you can guess what the theme, if you can uncrack, you know, this particular part of the show.
Yeah.
With a simple, like, you know, cipher, like, look at the quote. What is that quote in reference to? That's the music's going to play.
Yeah.
I mean, The Perfect Strangers was just such an interesting fit precisely because of the history that they'd woven throughout the show.
Yeah.
So I guess they got lucky. And that, although it's not really luck, because if it turns out that Marklin Baker is a moron, he dropped out of high school to pursue acting, and he currently believes in, I don't know, he's a Branch Davidian or something. Mm-hmm. And he would be a terrible person to be someone that carries a message to Nora Durst. They could just not do that, right? So it's like, it's only that they're smart in that they chose the right parts of the mythology to bring forward in the show.
Yeah.
Ben T from UK. Was that a flash forward at the end of the episode with Kevin Garvey Sr.? It's hard to say with the timelines, and Scott Glenn always looks old. Heyo.
Yeah.
But he'd kick your ass if he heard you talking that shit, Ben.
I agree, but
you don't want to fuck with Scott Glenn's wiry old man strength.
Yeah, I'm just going to say he sometimes looks like he could give Tommy Lee Jones a run for his money in the
crag
wrinkles
off
department. Yeah.
The wrinkle off.
Yeah.
Damien wrinkle off. But I have a feeling it might be a flash forward, and it's kind of segueing on last week's episode. But hey, I've been wrong many times before because of this show.
Yeah, no, I think
I
you're right.
I feel you on that, because if that could be Scott Glenn 15 years in the future, it could be Scott Glenn after 6 months of being in the Australian ozone hole and not right. wearing hats, you know?
No, but
I'm not going to wear those fucking cork hats, all right? Go fuck yourself if that's what you want. That's what
kidding me? I'm 180 years old and I still have hair this good? Get out of here. I'm not wearing a hat. I actually think you're right. I think this is a flash forward because these people have heard of Kevin. They know, you know, of his tales.
Yeah.
I don't think word has gotten out yet. Now, I certainly could be wrong. Michael could be spreading the good news here, but
yeah, or Matt and him could have a back channel.
Or Matt.
They're communicating through smoke signals through the television.
Right, but I got the impression that
agreed.
These people were not yet related to Kevin.
Yes.
And they clearly already knew about the larger Kevin, the book of Kevin.
Right.
So I'm thinking it's some flash forward.
And also Kevin Sr. would fucking know they're wrong.
Right. And the other bit that we've seen in Australia this year is a flash forward, undoubtedly. So,
well, unless it's Nora after she gets blasted by...
But it's still a flash forward.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be like a long
period of
time.
It doesn't have to be
20
years in the future, but you're right. It's before the... Okay, it's after... Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Where would you have ever seen on TV that scene of Nora catching Kevin choking himself? I mean, this scene is what separates some other serious dramas, maybe the exception of Game of Thrones. But that scene was priceless, and the chemistry and the acting between them is amazing. You know that any dialogue, you knew what each character was thinking. Yeah, you don't... I mean, that's why I was talking about last week, man. You don't see shows where people ritually try to kill themselves.
Yeah.
In interesting and inventive ways. And then other ones have not. Like in a standard drama, Nora would come home and be like, oh my God, this is crazy. You have to go see. She wouldn't just be like, oh, well, sure, that's what you're doing. Of course. Here's my Wu-Tang tattoo.
Yeah.
That's why I love it.
And it's how they blend those very serious, intense moments with ridiculous ones. Right. Right?
Yeah, like two grown-ass women bouncing on a trampoline to Wu-Tang Clan.
Or
like,
even in
brilliant.
The same moment, they have this ridiculous, this woman who's gotten a tattoo that she doesn't even know the name of.
Mm-hmm.
A completely ridiculous thing for Nora to do,
mm-hmm.
and yet it's so driven by her character and her emotions, and it's so intense. And
right.
I don't know how they managed to pull off the silly and the dramatic at the
it
same
is,
time.
Because, like, you know, I am very sensitive to tonal clashes,
right?
And I don't know why I like the show as much as I do, because it pivots from serious to absurd on just a dime.
I mean, this episode's full of it. Mark Lynn Baker on the face of it is a ridiculous, silly thing.
That's what I'm saying. Like, if I would have told you like a 2-paragraph pitch of this episode, you'd tell me that I was it's actually exactly like when Kevin said, if I told you this man had a picture of himself posing with a killer whale, you would say I'm lying. And then you show it and she's like, I feel like that's the audience reaction. If I told you that this episode was going to have, you know, Cousin Larry from Perfect Strangers with that, like, it would come off something like a bad Mr. Robot experiment.
Right. And the creators know.
Yeah.
The creators know exactly what they're doing with that.
Well, and that's the other thing I came across with Lindelof's interview, is that they watch a shit ton of television.
Yeah.
And in the off season, they're like, oh my God, you can do an ALF episode? You can get away with that?
Right.
Throw out the script for episode 2. Call up Mark Lynn Baker. Like, this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm always thinking about like what's going to keep propelling the golden age of television. I never considered it being a self-perpetuating machine, that all these creative people are seeing what all these other creative people are doing, and it further emboldens them. And even like The Leftovers could be a noble failure of an experiment. Maybe that's what it'll go down on, because not a lot of people are watching it. But what is it going to inspire? You know, what great television feeds into itself.
If I were inclined to be a writer right now and I'm watching what's on TV, Leftovers would be a huge inspiration for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not that person, but that person is out there.
Sure.
Yeah. And they're being informed by The Leftovers right now.
Right. I forget what they said. I can't. There's this, I think, a quote from a Rolling Stone about, like, hardly anyone listened to this particular band, but everyone that did formed a band in response to it, and then, like, that's, like, made Led Zeppelin and Cream and, like, all that. Fucking it all up, but, like, I do, like, only, like, 1 million people are watching The Leftovers, but every one of these people are going to start and make a television show in 2018.
Yeah.
And I'll blow my brains out because there's just too much. But anyway, Dan from Manchester, loved the latest episode, but want to discuss a line from last week. After deputizing the Gary Busey boys, Kevin says to Tommy, see what happens when you make people feel important? I think that line will sum up Kevin's trajectory this season. We know from the flashback episodes in season 1 that Kevin has been searching for a greater purpose his entire life, and he gets told by Kevin Sr. that man has no greater purpose. After dying 3 times and coming back and being told by people that you're special, somebody searching for a purpose could easily start to believe it, especially in a post-departure world. We even see in episode 2 how he clearly has a different view of the book than Nora, and that perhaps he's starting to believe it. I buy that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that this is like, in Leftovers fashion, we're going to come to understand that none of this is supernatural. This is just what happens when you make people feel important.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to my skeptic Aaron hat, the universe can do that through no fault of its own.
Yeah.
The universe can make you feel like you're more important than you are just from happenstance and random chain. Like, there's a guy, I think he's a park ranger, who's been struck by lightning 7 times.
Oh, God.
And he actually, I saw an interview with him where he's got like a collection of his ranger hats with the tops like blown off. And like, I think,
what is,
like,
this man doing at night?
Like this guy was born 400 years ago. He might be worshipped as a god.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, he probably would be.
Or, like, honestly, if he had the slightest of screws loose, he might himself buy into that and form a cult. Like, that's the difference between, you know, this park ranger gets struck by 7 lightnings, like, you know, no big deal, and, like, fucking David Koresh. or any other person that builds the cult around themselves. It's
I mean, you see that in business, you see that in all arenas of life.
Yeah,
people tell you that you are a certain thing, and you become that thing.
Yeah, like if his timing was off 6 months either way, Steve Jobs could just be some, you know, skinny nerd screaming at dudes in a garage.
Yeah,
and you'd never hear of him.
Or on a message board shouting at people, right? Like, oh, your products suck.
Right. Button, mouse, mice should only have one button.
Right.
Anyway, that's all we have for feedback. If you'd like to send us more, if you'd like to be considered for feedback on the podcast, you can send it in to leftovers@baldmove.com. We also had a ton of musicians come forward to volunteer music. Something that we need to talk about offline, and kind of I said as I was going through the feedback, I responded to each one and said, thanks for your volunteering. We're going to give it a listen and talk about what we're going to do. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week. Until then, I am the Drunken Desperado.
And I'm the Lucky Leader.